This is a Pinball News production.
Hi, my name's Clay Harrell. I'm responsible for some of the web information that's on marvin3m.com and pinrepair.com. Today, we're going to be talking about EM pinball machine repair and restoration. There is a sidebar I would like to talk about, though. How many people were here for the Gary Stern thing today? Okay. Again, this is personal conjecture, nothing more. Back in 1990, Gottlieb came out with this thing called the Street Series of Games, which was less expensive games, single level, no ramps, and they were competing against games like Williams Funhouse and Elvira and the Party Monsters and even some of the Data East games that Gary Stern was putting out. It was a series of about eight games that were meant to bring pinball down a level. It failed miserably. They tried it for eight games. They did not sell well. I mean, if you put these games against something like Funhouse or Elvira and the Party Monsters or whatever Data East was selling at the time, Back to the Future, what have you, they just did not do well. Now, I know that may not be exactly translatable to today's environment because obviously Gary Stern doesn't have any competition, really. But the reason why pinball is in decline has really less to do with the machines and their design and how they're put together and what they're trying to accomplish than it does just with our general social environment. That is, our culture today is more of a stay home, play computers at home, Wii's and stuff like that. And to actually backpedal, I don't think it's going to solve any problems. But, you know, I think what Gary Stern needs to do is he needs to talk to some people that have been in the industry a long time, like Mr. Kordak, sitting right here. I'm sure he could give them a lot more ideas. So, you know, I'm just saying, that's just me. And again, I'm not trying to put anybody down, but I think a little more thought needs to be put into that. And maybe some people with some greater expertise should be consulted. I just wanted to say that because I kind of felt bad for Gary Stern. In his current situation. And again, you guys can help a lot too. If you guys have games, you can operate them, and they don't have to be the newest games. Like, I've been operating Gottlieb electromechanical games, because you can buy, and we're going to talk about this some more in here, you can buy, EMs from the 70s for $500 or less. God, hell, go to Tom Taylor's booth back there, and you can buy some nice games and wamp them up, put coin mechs in them, put them down at, wherever, at whatever store you can get them into. And, it's not costing you a lot of money. And, yeah, maybe they'll only make $5 a week, but who cares? It makes pinball more visible, and it really does help. It puts pinball more into people's mindsets. If things... Americans, we got the worst freaking memory in the whole world. We can't remember anything. Look at the financial situation we went through a year ago, and people were already forgotten, how we got there, a year later. Well, if this to bring to pinball to that, if people don't see pinball, in bars or in locations or in video stores or wherever, it becomes more forgotten, and then it makes Gary Stern's job a lot more difficult. So, you guys can, everybody here in this room can help pinball. You really can. And, just don't sit back and let it die, because Expo, coming up here and talking about pinball, if it's dead, if Gary isn't here, it makes, the whole Expo thing less, and it's going to make your enjoyment in the hobby less. It's just going to diminish, where it just becomes a footnote in history, and I'm really not interested in seeing that happen. But, I can't single-handedly save this, and neither can Gary. So, take a little responsibility. Get some skin in the game. I know it requires a little work on your part, but, it's something that needs to be done. Now, to that point, I'm sorry, that turned out to be a little more depressing than I meant it to be. But to that point, there's some good things that have been happening in pinball lately. One of those good things is Tim Arnold's Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas, though I've recently had some disagreements with how he's doing his Pinball Hall of Fame. it's a good thing. I mean, he's basically about to open a new building. And, you know, he's planning on having 300 or 400 games in a single location in Las Vegas. It's a good public, you know, I mean, Las Vegas, I can't think of a better place to have a pinball museum in the United States than Las Vegas. It's a pretty good location. I mean, it's got a high population, high tourist area. It's in the middle of Sin City. It's some, you know, it's like an alternative to gambling. It's a great idea where he has it. But anyways, I've had some disagreements with Tim lately because I haven't felt that he's been keeping some promises that he's made to us over the years in regards to charity and that. But hopefully he's going to get back on track and get that all settled. But to another point, there's some other people across the country that are doing similar things. There's a new museum that's opened up in New Jersey that looks I haven't been there, but there was a nice article in the Pin Game Journal recently about it, and it looks really nice. You got David Silverman, who's, you know, around the D.C. area, Baltimore or something like that. You know, he's attempting a museum. I don't know how far he's gotten in that project. He's kind of a one-man show. So, you know, it's more difficult. Like the Tim Arnold approach is more difficult, too, because, again, it's kind of a one-man show. But this brings me to a bigger picture, and that's the guys in California. Now, how many people have heard of the Pacific Pinball Museum? Is any of you guys heard that? So most of you guys have heard of that. Okay, now, so these guys, they just sponsored a show a couple weeks ago, a pinball show, the PPE, the Pacific Pinball Expo. And they're doing a really nice job bringing their vision of pinball, which is, God, it's, you know, we're all Midwesterners out here, or East Coast guys, so, you know, we kind of take a look at things a little differently than the West Coast guys. You know, you get over the Rockies and things look different in that, you know, they have more of an artsy approach because they're, more in the San Francisco based, and they also have a good financial, you know, strength. You know, I'm from Detroit where it's hard to find a $10 bill. These guys are in California where, you know, they trip over $100 bills. So, you know, they've got better financial backing than probably most of these other guys. Plus, they're run by committee, meaning that instead of having just one guy like Tim Arnold or David Silverman, it's a group of guys that get together and have started this nonprofit to put together a museum out in California. And their show was a good indication of what they're doing. They had like almost 400 machines at their show, which is just incredible. So they've already got the machines. They've got the manpower. They're just trying to put together a museum. And I'd like to invite these guys up here just for a couple minutes to kind of talk about their vision, because I think it's really important, again, that pinball be in the forefront of the public. You know, you guys, sure, you guys live and breathe it because you're here, but to the average person, they don't live and breathe it. And, you know, if we miss this mark, and again, I am call out to all you people to help with this. If we miss this mark, pinball will die. And I don't want it to die, and you guys don't want it to die either. So I'd like to invite Michael Scheiss up here. He loves how I say his last name wrong. And he's got a somebody that he's going to introduce too.
Okay, well, it's Scheiss. Because as we all know... Thanks. Okay. Thanks. And thanks to Rob Burke for inviting Larry and I out here. He came to our show and extended a nice handshake. So Larry and I came out here today, and this is Larry Zartarian. He's our...
Yeah, we really appreciate the opportunity to be out here, and thanks to Rob and Mike for having us, and for Clay for giving us some time to talk to you all about our Pacific Pinball Museum that we are putting together. I'm the chairman of the board of directors of the Pinball Museum. Mike is our executive director, and Mike, this was actually his brainchild about 7 years ago.
Yeah, about 7 years ago. Just real quickly, I ended up with a bunch of EM pinball machines that I was going to basically scrape the paint off and retheme them. I thought the idea of pinball art as an interactive kinetic art piece would be pretty neat, but I just couldn't do it, and so I was left with all these machines. So I said, well, heck, they were driving me up the wall just sitting there, so I thought, well, there's no place to play these older machines, so I rented a little storefront and slapped on a shingle, called it the Lucky Juju, took all the coin mechs out so the city wouldn't get up my ass about having a license or any of that stuff, and I kind of went underground with this little pinball palace, and I called it Lucky Juju, so to throw them off even further. So after asking for donations for about a year and a half, nothing happened until we started getting art shows on the glass that surrounded it, and that's what kind of got people interested. And I noticed that a whole other group of people were coming to pinball. It was the retro hipsters from San Francisco would come to the Juju. So what that ended up happening at the time, I was working for the Exploratorium, which is a science museum, and I was building exhibits for them. And this was because I'm not rich. I don't trip over $100 bills, like Clay said. I got to work for a living. And
$50 bills.
So I was out in Washington, D.C., working for the National Geographic Museum, where on my day off, I'm a museum guy, so I went to go see the Smithsonian. Because I'd reading Clay's stuff and all the stuff about what to put on your play field. They said, the Smithsonian doesn't want auto body finish, you know, so don't put that on. You want to put on Verathane because they'll remove that. They want it all original. So I thought, wow, they got a hell of a collection out there. So I beeline it on Sunday over to the Smithsonian American Heritage Museum, and I'm looking up and down and everywhere for these dang pinball machines. Well, after about 3 hours of asking and looking, and I finally they tell me, oh yeah, we know what you're looking. It's down on the bottom floor, you know, it's behind the electrical, you know, behind the Edison exhibit. So I go down there and I look, and I found it, and they had one machine. And it was a Ms. Pac-Man video game. I was crestfallen. So I left there going, God, this is really crappy, you know. It's the greatest thing America ever did. And they got it shoved, and it's not even the right thing. So I was determined that there should be a pinball museum. And so we formed a nonprofit, and it started out as something else, but eventually became the Pacific Pinball Museum. So I know I didn't talk about what we do at the Juju.
I just wanted to give just a brief background, and I'm going to talk about where we are today and where we're going in the future. But in order to better understand those and put those in context, it's a good idea to view them as to where versus where we've been in the past. And just real briefly, as Mike said, this started out in 2002. It was more of a laid-back place where people could come, pay one admission price on open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, from 6 to midnight, Friday and Saturday, 4 to 8 on Sundays. And there'd be an art gallery and maybe 40 to 45 pins set up all on free play. And it was a very casual, kind of speakeasy, kind of family-friendly place to come and play pinball.
You used to be able to drink beer there.
Right. Where we are today is our collection actually has 650 to 700 machines in it, and we're in the process of restoring those games, getting them up and running, not just put behind velvet ropes. And what we are basically is we're trying to be more than just an arcade. Clay mentioned a couple of other efforts at museums that are popping up, not only domestically, but also I think in Australia, Michael Shaloub and Alan Tate have plans to open a museum there. In Paris, France, Raphael Lancar has a Paris Pinball Museum that's open by appointment only. What we want to do is not have a clubhouse or someone's garage where people can come and play pinball. We really want to make it educational and entertaining. So the golden carrot is really the pinball machines themselves. That's what's going to attract people into the Arcadium, is a term that we've come up with, sort of an arcaded museum. But to make it a museum and to really make it educational, you've got to focus on the science and art and history, not only of pinball, but these three things that are usually found in three separate museums. We want to combine them all into one museum, so to encourage people that if they're not careful while they're playing pinball, they will actually learn something about these three things that they'd normally find in three distinct museums. Our mission statement is actually to inspire an interest in science, art, and history through pinball, and to preserve and promote this unique part of American culture. Now, when we say preserve, we don't mean restoring the games and putting them behind velvet ropes and, you know, look but don't touch. Because that would be similar to kind of like automobiles in an automobile museum. They'd be like fossils. We really want to emphasize the fact that these are playable. They're kinetic. sculptures, kinetic works of art. They're interactive. They're meant to be played and enjoyed, not just looked at, and certainly not just standing on their ends in a warehouse with the heads apart from their bodies. So what we really want to try to be is the Smithsonian of pinball. If you were to walk into the Smithsonian, you'd expect to have to be able to see various significant pinball games and the evolution of pinball over time. We have games going back to the late 1890s all the way to today's modern games from every decade. We'd have an oral history section where you could put on headphones, listen to designers talking about how the games were designed, listen to artists talking about how they were made, or just enthusiastic collectors talking about their own collections and why they like pinball so much. All the games, as I said, will be on set on free play. We plan on having a restaurant, a gift shop, a restoration facility where we can lead seminars on how pins are restored, and classrooms to teach kids of all ages about how electricity works, for example, how physics work, look at the gravity of a pin table, mathematics, how scores are added up. But again, we really want to make it available to the public on a very interactive basis. If we were to put these things just on pedestals or behind velvet ropes, we really wouldn't be doing them justice, because what we really want to do is treat them with the reverence that they deserve for the past and the respect they deserve, but also make sure they have a relevance in the present and the future.
Yeah, I think one thing that is unique about this is that we're going for sustainability, because I've worked for a lot of museums, and a lot of them are run privately, some of them through public funding, and I've kind of lived in the nonprofit world. One thing that I've noticed is that they always need to come up with funding, and they have to be sustainable. And I've seen museums come and go because they didn't concentrate on sustainability. And I think the main reason is because they're not appealing to a wide enough audience. And so if you are just appealing to pinball players, you're going to lock it into just modern machines, and you're going to go with that. You're going to leave out the earlier machines and some of the unique machines and some of the details that get lost in the history part of it. So our key to the museum is sustainability by offering three venues of history, science, and art, and then also the amusement of the machines themselves. So,
you want to talk about the science and the art and history?
Well, one of the first things that I did was I started building kinetic art pieces. Now I can't do that anymore because they make me run the juju in the museum. But I managed to crank out the clear pinball machine, which was something I did with Wade Krause, who's a good friend of ours and is just an amazing guy who's done it by himself. He's built the helicopters machine. He built the Metallica machine. He did that with the artist Dirty Donnie. I got to help a little bit with that. But then Wade and I cranked out the clear pinball machine, which is basically just a surf champ that we rehoused in clear acrylic, and it was my abilities as a exhibit builder that allowed me to do that. And Larry and I will go to some of these, like the Maker Faire, and we'll bring the clear pinball, and it attracts a lot of people that normally wouldn't go near a pinball machine. The fathers come, little girls playing it. Everybody wants to flock around this thing to see how it works. So it's really doing a great job. And that's just one of the first exhibits that we worked on. We've got a whole slew of exhibits lined up for doing a whole series of the science of pinball. We just did the history of pinball, and we're putting together these touring packages, one of which is going to be going to Salt Lake City for one of the new museums there.
And actually, that's part of one of our fundraising efforts, is to have science exhibits not only built to sell to other hands-on science exhibit museums around the country, but also to put them on loan. And then another avenue of funding is building custom pins and having local artists and designers design and build them, and to perhaps sell them. There was the very well-known artist in the San Francisco Bay Area, William Wiley, who came up with the pun ball machine last year at our expo. He debuted it. It was based on a 1965 Gottlieb North Star. He made five of these on a theme of global warming and ended up selling one to the art museum in New York for $95,000?
Yeah, the first one was the San Jose Museum of Art. And then just recently was the first, strangely enough, it's like, what was that? I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, I'm out at the Smithsonian looking for pinball. And then one of our board members, Jim Dietrich, actually delivered the first pinball to the Smithsonian and set it up and played the first game. That was October 1st, I think it was. Yeah, where he actually set it up and played it. So it was kind of neat. That's probably the most expensive pinball machine, at least electromechanical pinball machine, sold, because they made seven of them. Some of them went for $125,000 apiece. So
the other funding project that we have is really, as Clay mentioned, was our Pacific Pinball Expo. This was our third year. We did have 379 machines there this year on the floor, and it had to be one of the largest stands of wood rails from the 50s. I think we had 72 wood rails set up and running at the show. It was very well received. We drew more people than last year, and we actually raised our ticket price. But that's really the one annual fundraiser that we have at the museum. We are a 501c3 IRS-sanctioned charitable organization. We do have a board of directors. We do have the collection in place. We're close to 700 machines now. We recently received a donation from Gordon Hosse, one of the, I think, hobby's most notable and well-known historians and collectors. That collection, by the way, includes one of every single player Gottlieb wood rail made from 1946, beginning with stage door canteen all the way through 1961's photo finish. We're in the process of restoring many of those games. We had 20 of them set up and running at this year's show. Gordon was rather thrilled about that, as you can imagine. He's only seen in his lifetime maybe 30% of these games actually set up and played before.
Yeah, at a show, Richard Conger, who's known as the pinball amasser, I think Tim Arnold's made fun of him in a few of his comic books, stacking them up like cordwood. But he has indeed been collecting since 1952, which is certainly before I started playing. I think I wasn't even a glint in my mother's eye at that point. And he's got just an incredible assortment. I think Clay's got some pictures he'll show later, unless your computer really did take a dump, that he's pledged to our museum, which is really was one of the main things we were looking for, was to complete the whole history of pinball, would be to have these earlier machines that often get overlooked. We have a board member who has the Rockola World's Rockola series and some of the earlier stuff. So with Richard's pledge, we're going to be able to display some of the earliest pinball machines that were created.
Yeah, what we really plan on doing for our museum is, if you attended our show, you saw a single hall that was 22,000 square feet. Basically, try and imagine a building twice that large with 650 to 700 machines all set up on free play. What we've tried to say is it's more going to be akin to a one-way ticket to pinball nirvana that is permanent. Not a round trip version, but a one-way to a permanent state of that. Along with, of course, a gift shop and a restoration facility, and then the emphasis on art, science, and history. And that's really what we're trying to do here. We don't have any interest in coining up machines in an arcade environment. We don't have any interest in putting them behind velvet ropes. We really want to make them interactive and enjoyed by the young generations of today, not just people like, well, look around you. I mean, there's very few people under 18 in this room. There's a reason for that, you know, because of the proliferation of video games. And as Clay was alluding to, if we don't step up to the plate and do something like this to not only preserve these mechanical marvels, when you think about it, I mean, they've got 3,500 components and half a mile of wiring in them. If we don't preserve them and make sure they have a relevance for the future generations, I'm not sure who else is going to do that. You think some of these machines are 50, 60, 70 years old. We want to make sure that 50, 70 years from today, they're still around and being enjoyed.
Unless they're underwater. No. One of the things, like, my wife came up with a series, and we're starting to work on this. It was kind of the history of fashion through pinball. And that got all these comments from all walks of life. It was pretty neat, though, because I know a lot of people get dragged to these shows, and some of them don't want to be there, but they all could relate to that, because they would read all the she'd write some pretty funny stuff about the pinball art and the fashion in it. So what we're going to be doing is putting together these packages that would tour around to other museums, hopefully to Tim's in Vegas, but also just regular science museums or art museums or even historical museums, to try and get the pinball love out there, basically by any means necessary. And museums are a great way to do it. It's starting to catch on a little bit, but you just you have to make a hook for people to get into it, and so that's what we're concentrating on, that and preservation. You want to talk about Metallica? No, we don't want to talk about Metallica. No, Metallica was one of the games that James Hetfield actually commissioned Dirty Donnie and Wade Krause to build. And I'll just say, it took them a lot longer. They took a shining on that one. But it was a pretty incredible machine. And another person that is in our warehouse, Tanya Kleiss, did some of the reprogramming on the sound and everything. And it was pretty amazing to see that. I don't know.
Gordon right now is in the process of editing. He's going to be editing Volume 3 and hopefully Volume 4. Volume 1 and 2 are out, the late Dick Bushell. The collection of Dick's entire archives are in Gordon's hands at the moment, but we have access to it until 3 and 4 are finished, then they become property of the museum. What we're talking about here is 200 bound, three-ring binders full of photos, black and white pre-flyer factory photos, for example, articles, books on pinball. Also, 40 bound volumes of Billboard journal from 1945 through 1963.
Yeah, Wade Krause is truly an amazing artisan is what I'd call him. His mother worked for, or grandmother worked for Disney, and so he got into graphic arts and has his own silk screening and everything. And so he silk screened the clear play field for the pinball, for the clear pin. Once we did that, we took I took a surf champ, stripped all the stuff down, sent it to him. He scanned it in sections, put it all back together, and then we took all the color out of it and left it with just black line art, so you could still see all the information on the playfield. Right next to that visible pinball machine, we have the a blown up schematic, and it's kind of neat because people, you know, they look at the machine, then they look at the schematic, and they get to make the immediate correlation, and it sparks a lot of interest in however these things work, and you get to explain about they're early computers in one sense. And then they also use ladder logic, which is real simple. And they also can be described in Boolean algebra equations. So you can take any series of switches and turn them into ands and ors and nots and nors and actually come up with a Boolean equation for each part of the circuit. So actually Jerry Ellsworth and I were talking about developing a computer interface to a machine where it would show you exactly what's being activated while you play it. And I know we talked about that. She made it sound a lot easier to do than I had imagined. So that was kind of interesting.
So. Just in terms of the milestones and programs and goals that we have, we've already secured the 501c3. We do have the board of directors. We have a world-class, very quite unique collection, we think, that's in the process of being restored. The main missing piece of the puzzle right now is to secure a permanent home. Our museum in Alameda, California, just across from San Francisco, across the Bay Bridge, is probably 3,000 square feet. We have room for 100 to 110, maybe, machines at any one time. In order to find the permanent home for what we have in mind of closer to 50,000 square feet and 700 machines, we really need a much bigger building that has the repair shop, the restoration facility, classrooms, etc. Right now in San Francisco, there's a building called the Legion of, or Palace of Fine Arts, close to the Golden Gate Bridge. It houses the Exploratorium, which is one of the nation's largest and well-known hands-on science exhibits, museums. They're in the process of moving to a bigger location in about a year and a half to 2 years from now. It's 200,000 square feet, and the city of San Francisco is talking about carving that up into fourths and maybe fifths, so that would be ideal for us. But right now, without a larger home, you've heard of pinball widows before, but right now these are pinball orphans, the machines themselves. They need a place to live. They're not red-haired, freckle-faced stepkids either. They're beautiful works of art. They're technological wonders, and they need to be preserved. So art, as I said, the real thing now for us is fundraising and to make it sustainable so that it pays for itself.
Yeah. One of the things that we're doing is in November 25th, we're opening our first traveling show, which is the History of Pinball, at the San Francisco Airport Museum, which is, I think, a one-of-a-kind museum that's been around for at least 20 years. And they have just really cool exhibits. They had one on jukeboxes that just blew my mind. And, you know, when you go to the airport, you don't expect to see this kind of thing. San Francisco Airport's evolved over the years. This exhibit goes from the 1898 Bagatelle all the way up to Adam's Family in the Twilight Zone.
Right.
And we supplied all the machines. We worked with Richard Conger, Larry, myself, and a few other collectors, Dan Miller, all supplied machines and helped write all the material and worked with this museum. And I believe it's the first of its kind, at least at an airport, and one that's that thorough. And it's going to be a beautiful exhibit, and it will also point to our newly expanded museum, which is going to be pretty nice. Should bring a lot more attention to pinball again.
In terms of what you can do to help us make our vision really become a reality is be an ambassador for pinball, be the sort of Johnny Appleseed, as it were, to tell people about pinball, the fun you've had with it, and just spread the word, get it out there. Contribute whatever you can, whether it's games. I'm sure some of you must know collectors that have garages full or maybe basements full of machines that are just standing on their ends collecting dust. Well, that doesn't do any good. Look into a planned giving program, perhaps giving machines, if not cash, paper ephemera, flyers, schematics, wiring diagrams, whatever it might be. These are tax-deductible donations, and they could benefit you in the long run as well.
Yeah. Those are some of the machines in the Juju collection. I personally go for European stuff. I got a lot of European stuff because that was an era that I never got to see, and that was at the end of pinball points inflation for the electromechanical stuff. Yes, I do have an affliction for Christian Marsh. I know it's not a healthy affliction, but
I think Steve has a question.
Do you have any kind of flyers or something that we can use showing the location?
I brought a box full of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We appreciate that. We brought a box full of them, so
yeah.
We'll make sure to give you some. We'll maybe put some out on the table here in the hallway. Yeah.
Thanks.
But
you want to be one of our spokesmen? You're hired. Also, we also brought some swag. Do you want to give that away? There's a whole box of, well, there's some,
got some t-shirts,
some posters and stuff. But I think you have to work for it, right? Oh, I also got some wood.
Does anyone remember how many games were actually at this year's Pacific Pinball Expo? No, it was 379. That was the correct number.
It's actually 372. But
how about the name of the first wood rail, single player wood rail in Gordon Hossie's collection?
Ooh.
People are paying attention. This is good.
All right. Well, I got one. What's the main difference between a OXO and Gulfstream? No, I'm on the playfield. I should specify. On the playfield, what's the difference between OXO and Gulfstream? No. No, it's one lane. They added one lane onto OXO up top. So I'd like that shirt. Yeah, if you look up top, there's the only difference is I didn't notice it until they were next to each other, and I went, oh. But you win anyway.
Okay, well, we got a medium and a small.
Absolutely, yeah. That's I think that's one area where we kind of veer off, and you have to. To be a true museum, you have to accredit yourself eventually. I mean, you can go quite a ways. There's a few schools, the one in San Francisco, actually, the Academy of Art. It was basically just a mill for foreign students. They were never accredited. And eventually they were forced to get accreditation. The San Francisco Airport Museum is accredited. And it's a process that is long and hard. And
you can also change your identity.
You could look at it that way, but I'd prefer to look at it as this is what we should exhibit, and that's why I don't want to get heavily into DMDs and just, you know, to satisfy the people that just want to play, is because the purpose of it is to display pinball throughout history, and
or at least throughout its evolution.
Yeah, and also the it's technical evolution, it's artistic evolution, and the playability of it. So to just hone in on one end of it doesn't satisfy our goals. You really got to show all of it. So
roughly 75% of the games in our collection are probably either mechanical or electromechanical, and maybe 25-30% are DMD solid state. That's really by choice, by design, as it were.
We didn't have a DMD until finally a Twilight Zone came up for sale for $1,200, and I said, "Okay, well, I guess I have to go get that." I'm glad I did. I was missing that part of pinball, but boy, as soon as that went into our museum, it was just like, "Well, everybody wanted more of that," and so we just stuffed it into one room. Said, "No, this is we'll go as far as this room, and that's it."
I think if you really want to communicate your message, you've got to be inclusive and show everything that's part of the evolution of whatever it is you're talking about, aside, putting your personal taste aside. I mean, personally, if it was my museum alone, I would have nothing but Gottlieb wood rails from the late 40s to the early 60s and Roy Parker and Wayne Nyan's design games. Mike here has more of an open architecture.
Well,
he loves all the
manufacturers. That's why Larry and I work well. I really like the really early stuff, the mechanical stuff, the Rockola stuff, and I also like 60s and 70s games. They're my favorites. And then he happens to collect all the stuff I can't afford. So one reason I got into getting pointy people, the Christian Marsh stuff, is because nobody wanted them. You know, I couldn't afford to pay much for these machines. Most people will let a Gulfstream or anything with a pointy person on it. They go pretty cheap. Well, I was lapping it up, so that's all I was going for. As soon as I saw a pointy person on it, yeah, I had to have it. So
another question here. Yes, our web address is pacificpinball.org, and we had, speaking of volunteers, we had close to 95 to 100 individual volunteers that helped us out at our show and helped the last 2 years as well. And without their support and enthusiasm and effort, it's just not possible. We are a nonprofit, and we don't get paid. All this time and energy is just strictly donated.
Yeah, I volunteer for Tim Arnold. I've done that 2 years. I couldn't do it this year. But, I mean, his task is just an incredible, daunting task that I'm not that good at fixing machines, and B, it's just like, where do you start? His pile was so huge. But he's managed over the years to get a lot of them going. But I can't honestly see how something like that can keep going without giving him he doesn't have gray hair yet, I guess, but does he have gray hair now?
He just hides it well.
Yes. Last time I saw him, he didn't. No, but that is something that we're looking into. Just to stimulate an interest in it, one of the things that caught my eye was golf, the golf tournaments where you have, because we happen to have like 18, 19 machines in the EM room, and it would be perfect to do something like that. It's got to be simple. I've been to a few tournaments, and it's pretty cutthroat, you know, and I can appreciate that, but, I mean, you get people really fighting over this stuff, especially if you have a cash award. But, yeah, that is something we want to do, kids' tournaments, things like that.
Yes. To answer the first part of the question is yes, we intend to restore every single game in the museum's collection. We're well on our way to doing that. As far as do we plan to document and have a DVD, I don't think...
We've written a manual that's basically for our own use. Working with Jim Dietrich of Pinball Revival, who was the originator for our show, he and I have written a manual, and it's still in progress, about wood rails first, because we want to have guidelines so that when people are working on these machines, you know, you fill out a form and you go through what everything that you do so that it's documented. And, you know, we'd probably just make that available if we come up with a manual that we think's pretty good that other people might want to, you know, share. I mean, it's hard to top what Clay's done, so we don't want to do that. We just kind of want to make guidelines so that people don't screw things up, because I think the first line is do no damage.
Yes, Cheryl.
Well, that's a good question. We're going to find out a little more as we expand our hours, because we've basically been just the weekend, you know, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then we have there's 12 people on the board. Some of them take turns doing private parties, anything we can to raise funds. We have a little pinball elf who comes and stays at my house with my wife and I, named Chris Nash, and I've never met anybody like Chris. A guy just lives. He wakes up, and the first thing he says, "Good morning. I'm going to go replace the coil on Flip-A-Card, you know, because it was a little janky. And then I'm going to go and work on the bingo machine." And then he's just got plans out his whole day about all the machines he's going to work on. Well, he spent 6 weeks with us, and enough said on that. He's just an amazing whirlwind. So. It's people like that. Tim Arnold has Hippie, I guess. And we've got our Chris Nash. And then there's a lot of other people will take a machine. Dave Nielsen, other people will take a machine into their shop and work on it. And these are people that we've known and trust. And then bring it back when it's restored. I even lucked out with one baseball game. It was a World Series, a Williams 1962 World Series, which... I didn't want to let go, but Dave Nielsen really wanted it, so I traded him a pot of gold and some cash to me, and then I gave him the World Series. And it was kind of rough. Well, he took it home and worked on it, restored it, and that's all he really likes to do. And then he brings it back and goes, "Oops," and asks, "Gee, can I park it here at the museum?" So basically, I got it, you know, totally restored for free.
I think Cheryl had a question here. Right. The question is... is it true that the Pacific Pinball Expos that you've been putting on the last 3 years are strictly fundraisers, and once you do get a permanent home for all these machines, you're not going to have the expos anymore? I think that the comment that I actually made during a seminar, Mike and I gave a couple of seminars during the show, was that it would be nice if we had the permanent home set up now, and that way we wouldn't have to move close to 400 machines back and forth, loading of two 53-foot 18-wheel trucks back and forth, handle them four times, because they'd already be home in the permanent collection, and there'd be no need to put on the show. Well, the reality of it is that the show has become so popular that it's going to continue for many years to come, so I can assure you of that. We had close to 2,800 people come this year, and about 27 last year, maybe 1,500 the first year, and we had them from all over the world. I mean, Brazil... Japan, South America, South Africa, all over the place. Yes?
Well, let's see. Actually, for our museum right now, since we're in the process of painting the additional parts, so we haven't plugged them in yet, but, I think it's about, well, for the warehouse, that's running about 150 to 200, because I changed it to all fluorescents, you know, for the lighting. And basically, we're not running machines down there. We're just working on them. And for the museum part, it's probably about $250 a month. It's not that bad, but we have in Alameda, we have a... it's probably less than that, actually. I'm estimating that's what it's going to go up to. It's about 75 per room. So that's 150, and then the additional room's going to bring that.
Any other questions?
No.
One thing I want to just add in closing is that you'll notice the name of our museum is the Pacific Pinball Museum. It's not the Pacific Pinball and Video Museum. That's definitely by design. It's not a mere coincidence, mainly because of technological and sociological reasons. On the technology side, video games to us just represent ones and zeros, and they're very predictable in terms of the software patterns. And once you've memorized the software levels, you can pretty much get to level 19 on Ms. Pac-Man or Donkey Kong or whatever it happened to be. And you couldn't get to level 20 unless you put in maybe $12 more in quarters. But by the time you got to level 20, you'd probably plateau out at some point because you can't move the joystick or press the buttons any faster than humanly possible. With pinball, you never know where the ball's going to go. It's totally random. On a sociological level, video games, I think, encourage players to stay in a dark room for 8 hours a day and just get involved in online gaming and don't get out and get a breath of fresh air. Whereas pinball is very sociological. People can stand around you, talk to you while you're playing. They can offer you advice or maybe criticize you. When I used to hang out at bowling alleys and arcades in Fresno, California, where I grew up, I used to be able to have my arm around my girlfriend, a cigarette in the hand, and a 2-liter bottle of Dr. Pepper on the top of a Target pool glass. You can't do that with a pinball machine.
Heck, you spill that stuff on it, it seems to go crazy.
The other aspect, I think, is just in psychologically, too. I mean, the two dominant forces, I think, at play at video games are really fear and hate, which are very expensive on a physical level and on a psychological level, where you're either afraid of being killed by the bad guys or you're killing bad guys. In pinball, no one ever gets killed playing a pinball. You might get hurt moving one or setting one up, but no one ever gets killed. In pinball, it's really about... The artwork's about titillation or compassion or maybe even love. Fear and hate are quite expensive, and I think love is really for free. Anyway. On that note.
Yeah, you're right about that. Hey, so again, thanks to Rob Burke for inviting us out
really
here.
We really appreciate
it. And Clay, thanks for letting us take up some of your time. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Yeah. Sorry, that was kind of an off our regular scheduled program. Since I'm the last guy of the day before the show opens in about 40 minutes, I still have a presentation to do. Just these guys, you know, they came up and I had some video from the San Francisco show, so it seemed to make sense to kind of incorporate them in there. They were only supposed to be up there 10 minutes, okay, not an hour. So... But anyways, so I guess it comes down. I've got some choices here for the crowd. I've got a presentation. I've got a PowerPoint presentation on doing mechanical restoration on Gottlieb 1970s multiplayer Gottliebs. I've got a PowerPoint presentation on restoring playfields. You know, basically how to touch up and clear coat of playfields. Gottlieb and some Williams. And then I've also got some movies that we could show, too. If we just wanted to show movie time, we could do that. I've got this guy that, when I was out in San Francisco, I visited this guy named Berkeley Mack, which, if you were here for Rob Hayes's presentation on collecting pinball stuff, this guy takes it to a level I've never seen in my life. And it's unbelievable what this guy has done in so little space and what he's collected. So I've got like a 10-minute video on that, and then I've got a half-hour video on the Silver Ball Ranch. Has anybody ever been to the Silver Ball Ranch north of San Francisco? Other than you, Larry. Other than you, Michael. Nobody. Okay, so this guy's name is Richard Conger. Has anybody ever heard of Richard Conger? Anybody? So yeah, we've got a few people. This guy is a former shop teacher that he's been collecting pinball machines since 1952. And he's mostly a pre-war collector, though he's kind of shifted his emphasis away from that as of late. But he probably has the largest pre-war pinball collection in the world. And I've got video of his place, and it's almost sick. I hate to show it, actually, in a lot of ways. It'll probably upset your stomach. But and I actually got in a big fight with him. Kind of like I got in the fight up here with John Cosmo. It's kind of very similar, but I got in a fight with them over collecting versus restoring versus, you know, having things available. And that kind of loops back into the Pacific Pinball Museum because he's kind of, Richard Conkers, he's 70 years old, would you say? 71. So he's up there in the years, and he's got this huge collection, and these guys are looking to adopt his collection so that they can actually get it restored and get it so where, you know, the public can see it. And but anyway, so by a show of hands, who wants to see Berkeley Mac? 10 minutes video. Okay? Who wants to see Richard Conger? And we could probably do both. Okay? A few less for Richard. Who wants a PowerPoint presentation on restoring 70s Gottliebs? Oh, wow, that's really sad. Okay, who wants a PowerPoint presentation on restoring playfields? It's a little better. But Berkeley Mac, okay, we're going to go. We'll go. You know, if you guys want to leave, it's fine. You don't, obviously don't need to stay. Nobody's got you chained. So what I'll do is I'll run Berkeley Mac, I'll run the Silver Ball Ranch, and then if there's anybody left, I'll talk about touching up playfields afterwards, which will run us beyond 6 o'clock when the show opens, by the way. Yes, sir. No, they're not on the web. That's a whole other story. But I just generally, the stuff that I present at the shows, I don't put on the web. And the reason, oh man, my laptop just died. There's a reason I do that. And the reason I do that is simple. It's because I figure when you come to shows, you come to shows. You guys spent a lot of money to go to the show. You bought all this stuff. And, you know, if you don't, just to give it out to everybody, it kind of dilutes the power of the show. And so it dilutes what Rob Burke and Pazak are doing. And, you know, because if you can see everything online, if you can hear every seminar online, if you can see pictures of everything online, if you can see video of everything online, what's the point of coming? You know what I mean? It really comes down to that, at least in my mind. So out of courtesy for the shows, stuff I present at shows is just for your eyes only. You know what I mean? And that's why I don't even really like it when Martin records my seminars and puts them online for that exact reason. It's because I think you guys paid the money. You paid the price. You guys are entitled to it. The people that stayed home, fuck them. You know what I mean? That's just how I feel. Sorry. But anyways. All right, Berkeley Mac.